Inside Short Tom's place, all was surprisingly neat and tidy, with clerks sitting behind two rows of desks, shuffling pieces of paper and making careful entries in two sets of ledgers.
Shut the bloody door! We don't give away heat to wasters!
Burns quickly shut the door. Hawk glanced at him and shook his head. Far too long in the West Side. He looked back at the clerks, who had finally realized who the newcomers were. One clerk opened his mouth to shout a warning.
Don't.
The clerk looked at the axe in Hawk's hand, thought about it, and shut his mouth.
Good boy.
Hawk looked about him, and the clerks shrank down behind their desks. Hawk smiled coldly.
My partner and I are going upstairs to have a nice little chat with Short Tom. Just carry on as normal. And by the way, if anyone has to come up after us and interrupt our little chat, I will be most upset. Is that clear?
The clerks nodded quickly and did their best to look as though the idea had never entered their heads. Hawk and Burns strolled casually between the desks and up the stairway at the back of the room. Burns watched the clerks' faces out of the corner of his eye. They'd all recognized Hawk by now, and there was real terror in their faces and not a little awe. Burns frowned thoughtfully.
I heard stories about Hawk. Everyone has, but I never really believed them. Until now.
They found Short Tom in his office, right at the top of the stairs. It was a nice little place, neat and tidy and almost cozy, with thick rugs on the floor, comfortable furniture, and attractive watercolor landscapes on the walls. Short Tom looked up as they entered, and his face fell. Not surprisingly, given his name, he was a dwarf, with stubby arms and legs and a large head. He wore the very latest fashion, and it was a credit to his tailor that he didn't look any more ridiculous than anybody else. He was sitting at a normal-sized desk on a custom-made chair, and he pushed it back slightly as he reached for a desk drawer.
I wouldn't. I really wouldn't.
Short Tom nodded glumly and took his hand away from the drawer.
Captain Hawk, how nice to see you again. Absolutely marvelous. What do you want?
Just a little chat. I've got a problem I thought you might be able to help me with.
I'm clean. 100%. I'm entirely legitimate these days.
Of course you are. In which case, you won't mind my bringing in the tax inspectors to go through all your invoices, will you?
What can I do for you, Captain?
Morgan's got a small mountain of drugs on his hands that he has to move in a hurry.
He hasn't contacted me. I swear he hasn't.
I know he hasn't. You're not big enough for this. But you can give me some names. With a deal this urgent, there's bound to have been talk already.
I've heard about your run-in with Morgan, and I can't afford to get involved. I'm just a small-time operator, dealing in whatever odds and ends the big boys can't be bothered with. As long as I know my place, no one bothers me. If I start talking out of turn, Morgan will send some of his heavies round to shut me up permanently. You'll have to find your help somewhere else.
Thousands of people could die if we don't stop this drug hitting the street.
That's not my problem.
Hawk raised his axe above his head. The axe head buried itself in Short Tom's desk, splitting the polished desktop apart. Hawk struck the desk again, putting all his strength into it. The desk caved in, sheared almost in two. Splinters flew on the air and papers fluttered to the floor like wounded birds. Short Tom sat very still, looking down at the wreckage of his desk. He raised his eyes and looked at Hawk, standing before him with his axe at the ready.
On the other hand, I've always believed in cooperating with the forces of law and order whenever possible.
Short Tom came up with four names and addresses, all of which Hawk recognized. Hawk nodded his thanks and left. Burns hurried after him, having almost missed his cue. His last glimpse was of Short Tom staring glumly at what was left of his desk. Burns followed Hawk down the stairs and back through the rows of clerks, all of whom were careful to keep their eyes glued to their work as the guards passed. Hawk and Burns stepped out into the street again, and Burns winced as the bitter cold hit him hard after the comfortable warmth of the offices. He stubbed his toe on something and looked down to find the two bravos who'd guarded the front door still lying where they'd fallen. Only now they were stark naked, having been stripped of everything they owned. Their flesh was a rather pleasant pale blue, set against the dirty gray of the snow.
That's the north side for you.
We can't just leave them like this. They'll freeze to death.
Yeah, I know. Give me a hand and we'll dump them back in the offices. Short Tom will take care of them. But let this be a lesson to you, Burns. Never give a Northsider an opening or he'll steal you blind. And the odds are there's not one person in this crowd who would have lifted a finger to help these two bravos. They'd have just left them there to freeze. In the North Side, people learn from an early age not to care for anyone but themselves.
Ah, is that where you learned it?
Hawk looked at him, and Burns had to fight down an urge to look away from the glare of the single cold eye.
I think we're going to get on a lot better if you stop acting like a character from a religious pamphlet. I don't know how you've managed to survive this long in Haven. I can only assume they've had a hot flush of civilization in the West Side since I was last there. Look, Burns, let's get this clear once and for all. I'm only as hard as I need to be to get the job done. I take no pleasure in violence, but I don't shrink from it either, if I decide it's necessary. I didn't see you holding back when we were fighting for our lives in Morgan's factory.
Ooh, that was different.
No, it wasn't. We're fighting a war here in the North Side against some of the most evil and corrupt sons of bitches the city has produced, and we're losing. For every villain we put away, there are 10 more queuing up to take his place. The only satisfaction we get out of this job is knowing that things would be even worse without us. Now, am I going to have any more problems with you?
No. You've made yourself very clear.
Good. Now help me get these two Bravos inside before they freeze their nuts off.
It didn't take long to discover that none of the distributors knew anything about Morgan's Super Chacal. The word from every one of them was that Morgan had gone to ground after his release from custody, and no one had heard anything about him since. Hawk gave them all his best menacing glare, but they stuck to their story, so in the end, Hawk decided he believed them. Hawk and Burns stood together in the street outside the last distributor's warehouse and looked at each other thoughtfully.
Maybe Morgan set up his own distribution network.
No. If he had, I'd have heard about it.
You didn't know about the Super Chacal?
That was different.
How?
The drug could be produced and guarded by relatively few people, hidden away in the pocket dimension. A new distribution system would need a lot of people, and someone always talks. No, Morgan has to be using an established distributor. Maybe someone who doesn't normally move drugs, but has the right kind of contacts.
Maybe.
Burns pulled his cloak tightly about him and stamped his feet in the snow.
So, what's our next step?
We go and talk with one man who might know what Morgan is up to. The man who knows everything that's going on in the North Side. Because nothing happens here without his approval. The big man himself. Saint Christophe.
Burns looked at him sharply.
Wait a minute, Hawk. Even I've heard of Saint Christophe. He takes a cut from every crime committed in Haven. Word is, he has a dozen judges in his pocket and as many counselors, not to mention a personal army of 400 men and a private mansion better protected than guard headquarters. We don't stand a chance of getting in to see him, and even if we did somehow manage it, he'd probably just have us killed on sight, slowly and very horribly.
Calm down. We're not going anywhere near his house.
Thank all the gods for that.
I've got a better idea.
Burns looked at him suspiciously.
If it involves bursting in on him where he works and smashing up his desk, you're on your own. Saint Christophe is the only person in the North Side with an even worse reputation than you.
Have you finished?
Depends. Tell me your idea.
Every day, at the same time, Saint Christophe has a bath and sauna at a private little place not far from here. It's pretty well guarded, but there's a way to get in that not many people know about. I did the owner a favor once.
And at what time of day does Saint Christophe visit this bathhouse?
About now.
I thought so. You've had this in mind all along, haven't you?
Stick with me, Burns. I know what I'm doing.
The private baths turned out to be a discreet little place tucked away on a side street in a surprisingly quiet and upmarket area right on the edge of the North Side. It stayed quiet and upmarket because the North Side's more successful villains used the area for their own rest and relaxation, and everyone else had the sense to stay out of their way. Everyone but Hawk. He walked breezily down an alleyway and slipped into the baths through a door marked Staff Only. Burns hurried in after him and shut the door quickly behind them, his heart beating uncomfortably fast. Hawk looked around once to get his bearings, then set off confidently through a maze of corridors that Burns wouldn't have tackled without a map and a compass. Every now and again they encountered a member of the staff, but Hawk just nodded to each attendant briskly as though he had every right to be there, and the attendant just nodded back and continued on his way. Burns grew increasingly nervous and felt a growing need to find a privy.
Are you sure you know where you're going?
You must learn to trust me, Burns. The owner himself showed me this route. We'll find St. Christophe in cubicle 17, just down this corridor here. Assuming he hasn't changed his routine.
And if he has?
Then we'll just walk up and down the corridor, slamming doors open till we find him.
He isn't kidding. Who knows who else might be behind those doors?
Byrne started to plot an emergency escape route back through the corridors, realized he was hopelessly lost, and felt even worse. Cubicle 17 looked like all the others, a plain wooden door with a gold filigree number. Hawk put his ear against the door and listened for a moment, then stood back and loosened the axe at his side. He strolled casually into the steam-filled sauna and leaned against the door, holding it open. Byrne stood behind him in the doorway, keeping one eye on the corridor in case some of the staff happened along. The steam quickly cleared as the temperature dropped, revealing St. Christoph sitting at the back of the room, surrounded by 12 muscular female bodyguards, wearing nothing but sword belts. The bodyguards surged to their bare feet, grabbing for their swords as they recognized the guards' uniforms. Hawk just leaned against the door and nodded casually to St. Christoph. Burns wanted desperately to draw his sword, but had enough sense to know it wouldn't help much if he did. His only hope was to brazen it out and hope Hawk knew what he was doing. He squared his shoulders, lifted his chin, and gave the bodyguards his best intimidating glare. If it bothered them at all, they did a great job of hiding it. Then St. Christoph stirred his considerable bulk on the wooden bench, and everybody's attention went to him. He gestured briefly to his bodyguards, and they all immediately put away their swords and sat down again, ignoring the two guards. Burns blinked. He couldn't have been more surprised if they'd all started speaking in tongues. St. Christoph was a big man, in more ways than one. Though no longer personally involved in any particular racket, every other villain in the city paid him homage, not to mention tribute. He funded a great many operations and planned many more, but never took a single risk himself. He ran his organization with brutal efficiency and was reputed to be one of the richest men in Haven, if not the Low Kingdoms. He had a partner, once. No one knew what happened to him. It wasn't considered prudent to ask. The man himself was over 6 feet tall and was reputed to weigh 350 pounds. Sitting down, he looked almost as wide as he was tall, a mountain of gleaming white flesh running with perspiration. Rumor had it there was a surprising amount of muscle under all the fat, and Burns believed it. Even sitting still, St. Christoph exuded an air of overwhelming menace, partly from his imposing bulk and partly from his unwavering, lizard-like gaze. His face was blank and almost childlike, his features stretched smooth like a baby's by his fat, an impression heightened by his thin, wispy hair. He moved slightly, and the wooden bench groaned under his weight. His bodyguards were already beginning to shiver from the dropping temperature, but he didn't seem to notice it. His gaze was fixed entirely on Hawk, ignoring Burns, for which Burns was very grateful.
Well, Captain Hawk, an unexpected pleasure. It's not often you come to see me.
I have a problem.
Yes, I know. You have a talent for annoying important people, Captain. But this time, you have surpassed yourself. The guard wants you suspended. A gang from the Devil's Hook has declared vendetta against you, and Morgan wants your head on a platter. You've had a busy morning.
It's not over yet. I need to know how Morgan is going to distribute his new drug.
And so you came to me for help. How touching. Why should I help you, Captain Hawk? It would make much more sense to have you killed, here and now. After all, you've caused me much distress in the past. You've shut down my operations, arrested and killed my men, and cost me a great deal of money. I really don't know why I didn't order your death long ago.
Because you couldn't be 100% sure they'd do the job. And you know that if they didn't kill me, I'd kill them, and then I'd come after you. And all the bodyguards in Haven couldn't keep you alive if I wanted your head.
St. Christoph nodded slowly, his face impassive.
You always were a vindictive man, Captain. But one day you'll push me too far, and then we'll see how good you really are with that axe. In the meantime, my offer to you still stands. Leave the guard and work for me. Be my man. I could make you rich and powerful beyond your wildest dreams.
I'm my own man. There isn't enough money in Haven to make me work for you. You deal in other people's suffering, and the blood won't wash off your money, no matter how many times you launder it through legitimate businesses.
Anyone would think you didn't like me. Why should I help you, Captain? You spurn my friendship, throw my more than generous offers back in my face and insult me in front of my people. What is it to me if Morgan is pushing a new drug? If it wasn't him, it'd be somebody else. The market's appetite is always bigger than we can satisfy.
This drug is different. It turns its users into maddened, unstoppable killers. A few hours after the drug hits the streets, there'll be hundreds of homicidal maniacs running loose in the city. The death toll could easily run into thousands. You can't sell your precious services to dead people, Christoph. You need me to stop Morgan because he threatens your markets. All of them. It's as simple as that.
Perhaps.
St. Christoph leaned forward slightly. His bodyguards tensed for a moment and then relaxed.
This is important to you, isn't it, Captain?
Of course, it's my job.
Nah, this is more than just your job. It's become personal to you. One should never get personally involved in business, Captain. It distorts a man's judgment and makes him vulnerable. Let's make a deal, you and I. You want something from me, and I want something from you. I will agree to shut down all distribution networks in Haven for 48 hours, more than enough time for you to find Morgan and put a stop to his plans. In return, you will leave the guard and work for me. A simple exchange, Captain Hawk. Take it or leave it.
No deal.
Think about it, Captain. Think of the thousands who'll die if you don't find Morgan in time. And you won't without my help. You really don't have a choice.
Wrong. You're the one who doesn't have a choice.
Hawk fixed St. Christoph with his cold glare, and the bodyguard stirred restlessly.
The guard still has some of the super chacal we confiscated from Morgan's factory. Whoever made the drug disappear from headquarters missed one batch. So either you cooperate and tell me what I need to know, or I'll see that when the drug finally gets loose, you'll personally get a good strong dose. If Haven's going to be torn apart because of you, I'll see you go down with it.
You wouldn't do that.
Hawk fixed his gaze on St. Christoph with a look that could bore through granite. The atmosphere in the sauna grew dangerously tense. Burns glanced from Hawk to St. Christoph and back again, but neither of them looked to be giving way. He let his hand drift a little closer to his sword. All it would take was one sign from St. Christoph, and the 12 bodyguards would attack. Hawk might actually be able to handle 6-to-1 odds with that axe of his, but Burns had no false illusions about his own fighting skills. Maybe, if he was quick enough, he could jump back and slam the door in their faces, slow them down enough for him to make a run for it. But that would mean abandoning Hawk.
Very well. I agree. I'll see to it that the distribution networks are shut down for 24 hours.
You said 48.
That was a different deal. You have 24 hours, Captain. I suggest you make good use of them, since, regretfully, I have no idea as to where Morgan might be at present. He seems to have disappeared into a hole and pulled it in after him. And, Captain, when this is all over, you will answer to me for your threats and defiance. Please, close the door on your way out.
Hawk turned and left without speaking. Burns hurried after him, shut the cubicle door firmly, and then ran after his partner as he strode off down the corridor.
I don't believe what I just saw. You faced down St. Christoph without even drawing your axe and got him to agree to help the guard. That's like standing in a harbor and watching the tides go out backwards.
It was in his interest to help, and he knew it.
Where did you find the extra batch of Super Chacal? I thought it had all disappeared.
It did. I was bluffing.
Burns looked at him speechlessly.
There's more to surviving in the north side than knowing how to use an axe.
Hawk was never sure how he knew when he was being followed, but over the years, he'd learned to trust his instincts. He glanced at Burns, but he was apparently lost in his own thoughts and hadn't noticed anything. Hawk slowed his pace a little and found various convincing reasons to look innocently around him. He frowned as he spotted not one tail, but several, moving casually through the crowd after him and Burns. Whoever they were, they must be pretty good to have got so close without his noticing them before. Hawk's frown deepened as he realized the tails were gradually moving so as to surround him and Burns. It was looking more and more like an ambush, and they'd chosen a good spot for it. The street was growing increasingly narrow and was blocked off at both ends by market stalls. There were alleyways leading off to both sides, but none of them seemed to lead anywhere helpful. And the next main intersection was too far away if it came to running. Besides, Hawk didn't believe in running. He let his hand fall casually to the axe at his side and looked for the place to make a stand.
I make it 7. They picked us up not long after we left the baths.
I wasn't sure you'd even notice we were being followed.
Working in the west side, I spent a lot of time escorting gold and silversmiths to the banks with their week's receipts. There's nothing like guarding large amounts of money in public to make you aware of when you're being followed. So what are we going to do? Make a stand?
I don't think we have much choice. And it's 8, not 7. See that man in the doorway, just ahead, pretending not to watch us?
Yes. Damn. And if we can see 8, you can bet there are just as many more lurking somewhere handy out of sight, just in case they're needed. I don't like the odds, Hawk.
It could be worse.
Who do you think they are? Morgan's people?
Seems likely. He must have known I'd have to go to St. Christophe eventually, so he just staked the place out and waited for us to turn up.
Damn, I hate being predictable. We could go back to St. Christophe and ask for protection.
You have got to be joking. He'd love that. Besides, I have my reputation to think of.
If we don't think of something fast, you're going to be the most reputable corpse in the north side.
Calm down, Burns. You worry too much. If the fighting ground is unfavorable, then the obvious thing to do is change the fighting ground. You see that fire escape stairway to your right?
Yes. What about it? Hey, wait a minute, Hawk. Whoa, you can't be serious.
Shut up and run.
Hawk sprinted forward, with Burns only a pace or two behind. Their followers hesitated a moment, and then charged after them, forcing their way through the crowd with brutal efficiency. Hawk reached the metal stairway and ran up it without slowing, taking the steps 2 at a time. Burns hurried after him, the fire escape shuddering under their combined weight. Hawk pulled himself up onto the roof and scurried across the uneven tilework to crouch beside the nearest chimney. Burns clattered unsteadily across to join him and clutched at the chimney stack to steady himself. Hawk shot him a grin.
Check the other side of the roof. See if there's any other way to get up here. I'll prepare a few nasty surprises.
You're just loving this, aren't you?
Burns hugged tight to the chimney.
What's the matter with you?
I hate heights.
Oh, stop complaining and get over to the other side. This is the perfect spot to take them on. Lots of hiding places. And they're just as much at a disadvantage as we are. Trust me, I've done this before.
Burns scowled at him, reluctantly let go of the chimney, and moved cautiously across the tiles toward the spine of the roof.
All right, what's the plan then?
Plan? What do we need a plan for? Just find something to hide behind and jump out on anything that moves.
Burns disappeared over the roof edge.
Sure, jump at anything that moves and send myself off the roof.
Hawk looked quickly about him, taking in the gables, cornices, and chimney stacks that jutted from the undulating sea of roofs to either side. He drew his axe and waited patiently in the shadows of the chimney, listening for the first giveaway sound. It was at times like this that he wished he carried a length of tripwire. He looked around him, taking in the state of the roof. A lot of snow had fallen away from the tiles, pulled loose by its own weight and the vibrations of passing traffic below. But there was enough left to make the tiles suitably treacherous.
Oh, son of a...
A sudden thud from the other side of the roof suggested that Burns had reached the same conclusion. Hawk grinned suddenly as an idea hit him. He moved carefully away from the chimney, unbuttoned his fly, and urinated over a stretch of apparently safe tile work. It steamed in the air, but froze almost as soon as it spread out across the tiles. Hawk finished and quickly buttoned up again.
Whew, that's cold.
He looked around sharply as he caught the muffled sound of boots treading quietly on the metal stairway, and he scurried back to crouch down on the opposite side of the chimney stack. He breathed through his nose so that his steaming breath wouldn't give him away, and clutched his axe firmly. He listened carefully as the first man stepped off the stairway onto the roof, hesitated, and then moved slowly forward. Timing his move precisely, Hawk suddenly emerged from behind the chimney, swinging his axe in both hands. Morgan's man spun around just in time to receive the heavy axe head in his shoulder. The blade sheared clean through his collarbone, and blood flew steaming on the bitter air. The impact drove the man to his knees. Hawk pulled the axe free, put a boot against the man's shoulder, and pushed. The man-at-arms slid helplessly across the roof and over the side. Hawk heard footsteps behind him and turned just in time to see the second man hit the patch of frozen urine. The swordsman's feet shot out from under him and he all but flew off the edge of the roof. The third man was standing by the fire escape with his mouth hanging open. Hawk bent down, snatched up a handful of snow and threw it at him. As the man raised a hand instinctively to guard his face, Hawk stepped carefully forward and swung his axe in a vicious sideways arc. The axe head punched clean through the man's ribcage and sent him flying backwards. He disappeared over the edge of the roof and fell back down the fire escape. Hawk grinned. He hurried forward, and his feet shot out from under him. He hit the roof hard and slid toward the edge.
Idiot! Slipped on your own piss!
He threw aside his axe and grabbed at the iron guttering as he shot past it. He got a firm grip on the trough with both hands, and the sudden shock of stopping almost wrenched his arms from his sockets. The guttering supported Hawk's weight, and he hung there for a moment, his feet dangling above the street far below. Then he started to pull himself back up. The trough groaned again and shifted suddenly. A rivet tore free, and Hawk froze where he was.
Oh, right.
The guttering didn't look at all secure, especially when seen from underneath, and he didn't think it would hold his weight much longer. On the other hand, one sudden movement might be all it would take to pull it away completely. He pulled himself up slowly and carefully, an inch at a time, ignoring the sudden groans and stirrings from the ironwork, and swung one leg up over onto the roof. A few moments later, he was back on the roof, reaching for his axe and wiping sweat from his forehead. The sound of approaching feet on the fire escape caught his attention again, and he grinned suddenly as a new idea came to him. He moved carefully across the tile roof to the metal stairway and looked down. 7 men-at-arms were heading up towards him. They looked grim and very competent. Hawk waved at them cheerfully, and then bent forward and stuck his axe head between the side of the stairway and the wall. He threw his weight against the axe, and the fire escape tore away from the wall with almost casual ease. Put his axe away. Sometimes there was a lot to be said for cheap building practices. He clambered up to the roof ridge and looked down the other side. Burns was crouching at the edge of the roof, sword in hand, keeping watch from behind a jutting gable. There was no sign of any more men-at-arms.
Burns!
Burns jumped half out of his skin. He spun around, sword at the ready, and then glared balefully as he saw it was only Hawk.
Don't do that!
Sorry? I take it none of the men-at-arms got this far?
Haven't seen hide nor hair of them. I don't think they were interested in me, only you. How many came after you?
10.
Bloody hell! What happened to them?
Well, we had a falling out.
They made their way back to headquarters, but though there were no further incidents, Hawk couldn't shake the feeling they were still being followed. He tried all the usual tricks to make a tail reveal himself, but he didn't see anyone, no matter how carefully he checked. It was always possible his current situation had him jumping at shadows, but he didn't think so. The crawling itch between his shoulder blades stayed with him all the way back to guard headquarters. He stopped at the main doors and peered wistfully down the street at the Cloudy Morning Tavern. A drink would really hit the spot now, after a long day's exertions, but he could just visualize the look on Burns' face if he were to suggest it. All the partners he could have chosen, and he had to pick a saint in training. Hawk strode scowling into headquarters, and everyone hurried to get out of his way. Burns walked silently beside him, nodding casually to familiar faces. He'd been unusually quiet ever since Morgan's people jumped them. Hawk shrugged mentally. Apparently Burns was still mad at him for not trying to bring in his attackers alive, as if he'd had a choice with 10-1 odds. They made their way through the building, going from department to department, ostensibly just passing the time of day with their co-workers, but always managing to slip in the occasional probing question. It was hard going. None of the guards wanted to talk about Morgan or his drugs, and in particular, no one wanted to be seen talking to Hawk. Overnight, he'd become bad news, and no one wanted to get too close in case some of the guilt rubbed off on them. The sudden reticence was unnerving. Usually, headquarters was buzzing with gossip about everything under the sun, most of it unprovable and nearly all of it acrimonious. But now all Hawk had to do was stick his head around a door and silence would fall across the room. Hawk gritted his teeth and kept smiling. He didn't want anyone to think the silence was getting to him. And slowly, very slowly, he started getting answers. They were mostly evasive and always hushed, but they often told as much by what they didn't say as by what they did. And the picture that gradually emerged was more than a little disturbing. Mistress Melanie of the wardrobe department uncharacteristically came up short on gossip.
Captain Hawk, I handle costumes. How would I know about someone like Morgan or the latest street drug? Even if I did, it seems someone higher up isn't eager for you to find out. I did hear the Morgan case is closed. Not that I know anything about him. But the case is closed. Permanently. Apparently, someone high up got involved. Someone in addition to headquarters.
That was unusual. Corruption in the higher ranks of the guard tended to be political rather than criminal. A clerk in intelligence quietly intimated that at least one guard captain was involved. A pretty well-regarded captain, too. He wouldn't even hint at a name. Hawk and Burns hung around the constable's cloakroom for a while, but it soon became clear that the constables were uneasy in their company and had nothing to say. The forensic laboratory was up to its eyes in work as usual, and the technicians were all too busy to talk. Vice, forgery, and confidence tricks were all evasive and occasionally openly obstructive. Hawk had his enemies in the guard, and some saw this as their chance to attack while he was vulnerable. Hawk just kept on smiling and made a note of certain names for later. Of all the departments, the murder squad turned out to be the most forthcoming, probably because no one was going to tell any of its members who they could and couldn't talk to. They were the toughest of the tough, took no nonsense from anyone, and didn't care who knew it. Unfortunately, what they knew wasn't really worth the telling.
The constables took the crates of Super Shakar down to the storage cellars and signed it in all according to procedure. But when the time came to check the contents, no one could find the crates. Everyone in store swore blind that no one could have got to the drugs without breaking store security. And all the wards and protections were still in place, undisturbed. That means an inside job. Someone in stores turned. But when the stores personnel underwent truth spell, they all came out clean as a whistle. So whoever took the drugs had to be someone fairly high up in the guard, with access to the right keys and passwords.
What about a captain on the take? Thanks for your time.
That just left the drug squad. But as Hawk expected, no one there would talk to him. They were already under suspicion themselves, and weren't about to make things worse by helping a pariah like Hawk. He nodded politely to the silent room, and then he and Burns left to do some hard thinking. They found an empty office, barricaded the door to keep out unwelcome visitors, and sat down with their feet propped up on either side of the desk.
The more I learn, the less this case makes sense. There's no way anyone could have got those crates out of the stores without somebody noticing. Passwords or no passwords. I mean, you'd have needed at least half a dozen people just to shift that many crates. Someone in stores has got to be lying.
But they all passed the truth spell.
That doesn't necessarily mean anything. It's possible to beat the truth spell, if you know what you're doing.
It could have been sorcery of some kind. Morgan had one sorcerer working for him in that factory. Who's to say he doesn't have another one working for him?
It could be. Hell, I don't know. I don't know anything anymore. Did you see their faces in the drug squad? I know those people. I've worked with practically everyone in that room at one time or another, and they looked at me like I was a stranger. It was the same with all the others. They don't trust me anymore. And the fact of the matter is, I don't trust them either. I don't know who to trust anymore. You heard what intelligence said. It isn't just a captain who's on the take, it's a well-respected captain. There aren't too many of those.
Maybe we should go talk to Commander Glenn.
No, I don't think so.
Are you saying you don't trust Glenn either? He's the one who gave you this brief, told you to find out what's going on.
He's also the one who let Morgan go. And it's clear there's been a lot of pressure coming down from above to keep people quiet. What better way to conceal a potentially embarrassing investigation than to be the one who set it up?
But why would someone like Glenn bother about a few missing drugs?
He wouldn't. More and more, it seems to me the drugs are only a part of this. Something else is going on, something so big they can't afford for it to come to light.
They?
Who knows how far up the corruption goes? Why stop at a captain or a commander? Morgan said there was a lot of money to be made out of this Super Shakal. Millions of ducats. And don't forget, most of the top people in the guard are political appointees. And there's a damn sight more corruption in politics than there ever was in the guard.
Hawk, this is starting to sound very paranoid. We're going to need an awful lot of hard evidence if we're to convince anyone else.
We can't go to anyone else. We're all alone now. We can't trust anyone, not our colleagues, not our superiors, not our friends. Anyone could be working for the other side.
Hawk looked intently at Burns.
You know, you don't have to stay with me on this. When I asked you to be my partner, I didn't know what we were getting into. There's still time for you to get out if you want. Things could get very nasty very quickly once I start pushing this.
You're not getting rid of me that easily. Especially not now the case is getting so interesting. I'm not convinced about this massive conspiracy of yours, but there's no doubt something fascinating is going on.
I'm with you all the way, until we break the case, or it breaks us. Morgan's people killed my partner. I can't turn my back on that. So, what's our next step?
There's only one place we can go. The Guard Advisory Council.
Burns gaped at him.
You've got to be kidding. They're just a bunch of businessmen, guard retirees in idealistic quality, who like to see themselves as a buffer between the guard and the council's politics. They mean well, but they're about as much use as a chocolate teapot. I mean, they're very free with their advice, but they don't have any real power. They're mostly just public relations. How can they help us?
They're all people in a position to have a finger on the pulse of what's happening in Haven. And just maybe they're divorced enough from both guard and council not to be tainted by the present corruption. Maybe we can get some answers there we won't get anywhere else. It's worth a try.
Yes, I suppose it is. Hawk, this captain who's working for Morgan, what if it turns out to be someone we know? Maybe even a friend?
We do whatever's necessary, whoever it is.
Burns looked as though he was going to say something more.
What?
Burns and Hawk took their feet off the desk and glanced at each other.
Captain Hawk, I have a message for you.
How did she know where to find me? No one's supposed to know where we are.
What do we do?
Answer, I suppose. What do you want?
Captain Hawk, I have a message for you. I'm supposed to deliver it in person.
Hawk hesitated and then shrugged. He pulled away the chairs holding the door shut and drew his axe. A guard constable looked at him and the axe and nodded respectfully.
Sorry to disturb you, Captain. It's about the child you rescued from under the collapsed tenement. The little girl?
I remember her. Has there been some improvement in her condition?
I'm sorry, sir. She's dead. I'm told she never regained consciousness.
I see. Thank you.
The constable nodded and walked away.
Damn. Ah, damn.
Out in the corridor, the constable smiled to herself. The news had obviously shaken Hawk badly, and anything that slowed Hawk down had to be good for Morgan and his backers. The constable strode off down the corridor, patting the full purse at her belt. Fisher peered out the study window, chewing thoughtfully on a chicken leg she'd liberated from the delegate's lunchtime snack after they disappeared back into the pocket dimension. She'd spent the last half hour checking out the house security and searching for weak spots, but had to admit, Apoen seemed to know what he was doing. Every door and window had locks or bolts or both, and they were all securely fastened. Men-at-arms in servants' livery guarded every floor, making their rounds at random intervals so as not to fall into a predictable routine. Routines could be taken advantage of. There were caches of weapons stashed all over the house, carefully out of sight, but still ready to hand in an emergency. Outside, the grounds were a security man's dream. All the approaches stood wide open, nowhere for anyone to hide, and the thick covering of snow made the lawns impossible to cross without leaving obvious tracks. All in all, everything lay calm and peaceful and showed every sign of staying that way. It all left Fisher bored. Apoen's people seemed to regard her as an outsider and her appointment as some kind of negative appraisal of their own abilities. As a result, none of them talked to her. Apoen himself seemed friendly enough, but it was clear he was the worrying type, constantly on the move, checking that everything ran smoothly. Fisher wandered aimlessly around for a while, committing the layout of the house to memory and trying to get the feel of the place. The old house creaked and groaned under the weight of the winter cold and seemed built on a somewhat erratic design. Rooms lay within rooms, corridors led nowhere, and shadows fell in unexpected places. But everything that could be done to make the house secure had been done, and Fisher couldn't fault Apoen's work. She should have felt entirely safe and protected, and it came as something of a surprise to her to find that she didn't. Deep down inside, where her instincts lived, she couldn't shake off the feeling she and everyone else in the house was in danger. No doubt part of that uneasiness came from knowing there was a pocket dimension nearby. After what happened in the Hook, Fisher felt more than a little leery of such magic, for all of Apoen's reassurances. But more than that, she had a strong feeling of being watched, of being under siege. She had only to look out of a window to feel the pressure of unseen watching eyes, as though somewhere outside a cold professional gaze studied her dispassionately, considering options. So she ended up back in the study, staring out the wide window at the bare, innocent lawns, and wondering if she was finally getting paranoid. Apowen acted as if he expected an attack at any moment, and she was beginning to understand why. There was a definite feeling of anticipation in the air, of something irrevocable edging closer, as though her instincts were trying to warn her of something her mind hadn't noticed yet. She threw aside her chicken leg, turned her back on the window defiantly, and looked around for something to distract her. Unfortunately, the study stood briskly austere, with the bare minimum of chairs and a plain writing table. Bookshelves lined two of the walls, but their leather-bound volumes had a no-nonsense, business-like look to them. One portrait hung on the wall behind the desk, its subject a straight-backed, grim-faced man who apparently hadn't approved of such frivolities as having a portrait painted. The study had clearly been intended as a room for working, not relaxing. Fisher leafed through some of the papers on the desk, but Apowen's handwriting was so bad they might have been written in code for all she could tell. She looked thoughtfully at the wine decanters left over from the delegate's break, and then looked away. She'd been drinking too much of late. So had Hawk. Haven did that to you. There was a definite crawling on the back of Fisher's neck, and she strode back to the window and glared out at the featureless scene again. The snow-covered lawn stretched away before her, vast and unmarked. There were no trees or hedges, nothing to hide behind. Everything stood quiet. She didn't bother to cover her mouth. She'd been hoping to snatch a couple of hours' sleep here, but it seemed her nerves were determined to keep her restless and alert. She almost wished someone would attack just to get it over with. She started to turn away from the window and then stopped, startled, and looked quickly back again.
Wait a minute.
The wide-open lawns were empty and undisturbed. No one was there. But for a moment, she could have sworn. It came again, a sudden movement tugging at the edge of her vision. She looked quickly back and forth, frustrated that she couldn't see what her instincts told her was there.
Ugh.
There couldn't be anyone out there. Even if they were invisible, they'd still leave tracks in the snow. Things moved at the corner of her eye, teasing her with glimpses of shapes and movement that refused to come clear. She backed slowly away from the window and drew her sword. Something was happening out there. Fisher spun around, dropping into a fighter's crouch. Apowen raised an eyebrow, and she flushed angrily as she straightened up.
Oh, damn it! Don't do that! Come and take a look, Apowen. Something's going on outside.
I know. Half my people are giving themselves eye strain trying to get a clear look at it.
Do you know what it is?
I have a very nasty suspicion.
Apowen moved over to join her before the window.
I think there's someone out there hiding behind an illusion spell. It must be pretty powerful to hide his trail as well. But as he gets closer to the house, the protective wards are interfering with the spell, giving us glimpses of what it's hiding.
You think it's just one man?
Not really, no. Just wishful thinking. I've put my people on full alert, just in case.
Does whoever's out there know we've spotted something?
Beats me. But they haven't tried anything yet, which suggests that they still trust in their illusion to hide their true strength.
Fisher scowled out the window and hefted her sword restlessly.
All right. So what do we do now?
Wait for them to come to us. Let's see if they can even get in here before we start panicking. After all, it would need a bloody army to take this house by force.
The world jerked sideways and back again as the house's wards finally broke down the illusion spell and showed what lay behind it. The wide lawns were covered with armed men, and more were pouring through the open gates. Dressed in nondescript furs and leathers, they advanced on the house in a calm, professional way.
Damn, there must be at least 200 men out there.
The four marble statues had come alive and were cutting a bloody path through the invaders. They were coldly efficient and totally unstoppable, but were hard put to make any impression on so many invaders. Half a dozen guard dogs blinked in and out of existence as they threw themselves at the intruders, leaping and snapping, and now and again tearing at a man on the ground. But again, there were simply too few of them to make any real difference. No one expected or planned for an invasion on such a scale as this.
I don't want to disillusion you, Apowen, but it looks to me like they've got a whole army. We are in serious trouble.
You could well be right. From the look of them, they're mercenaries.
Guard!
Four footmen burst in, each carrying a longbow and a quiver of arrows. Apoen grinned at Fisher.
They don't have much use for bows in the guard, but I've always believed in them. You can do a lot of damage with a few bowmen who know what they're doing.
No argument from me. I've seen what longbows can do.
The footmen set up before the window, pulling off their long frock coats to give them more freedom of movement. Fisher and Apoen struggled with the bolts that held the window shut until Fisher lost her temper.
Oh, hell with it.
Apoen threw the window open and stepped back to let the archers take up their position. Bitter cold streamed in from outside, and the archers narrowed their eyes against the glare of the snow. The attacking force realized the grounds were no longer hidden behind the illusion spell and ran toward the house. Sunlight flashed on swords and axes and morning stars. Fisher couldn't even guess how many attackers there were anymore. The archers drew back and released their bowstrings in a single fluid movement, and four of the attackers were thrown backwards with arrows jutting from their bodies. Their blood showed vivid red on the snow. The archers let fly again and again, punching holes in the attacking force, but they just kept coming, ignoring their dead and wounded.
They're professionals, all right. Mercenaries. Could be working for any number of people. Whoever it is must want us shut down really badly. An army that size doesn't come cheap. I didn't think there were that many mercenaries for hire left in Haven.
How long before reinforcements can get here?
There aren't going to be any. We're on our own. Low profile, remember? Officially, no one knows we're here.
And we're expendable.
Right. We either win this one ourselves, or we don't win it at all. What's the matter? Don't you like a challenge?
I'd like a challenge just fine.
The first handful of mercenaries to reach the window ducked under the flight of arrows and clambered up onto the windowsill. The archers threw aside their bows and grabbed for their swords. Fisher thought briefly of the door behind her. She didn't believe in suicide missions. On the other hand, she didn't believe in running either. She moved quickly forward to join Apoen and the archers, and together they threw the first mercenaries back in a flurry of blood and gore. More of the attackers crowded in to take their place. The noise was almost deafening at close range. Fisher glanced at Apoen, saw him palm a pill from a small bottle and swallow it. He caught her gaze and smiled.
Just a little something to give me an edge. Want one?
No thanks. I was born with an edge.
Suit yourself. Here they come again.
He breathed deeply as the drug hit him and smiled widely at the mercenaries.
Come and get it, you lousy bastards! Come on! Come all!
The main bulk of the attack force hit the windows like a breaking wave and forced the archers back by sheer force of numbers. Fisher was swept aside, fighting desperately against a forest of waving blades. In moments, the room was full of mercenaries, most of whom ran past the small knot of beleaguered defenders and on into the house. Fisher and Apoen ended up fighting back-to-back, carving bloody gaps in the shifting press of bodies. The archers fell one by one, and Fisher and Apoen were slowly driven back across the room, away from the window. As more mercenaries poured in, there seemed no end to them.
You bloody bastards! I got a cure for what ails you! A sharp cure!
None of the mercenaries could get anywhere near Owen in his euphoric state. Fisher fought doggedly on. Mercenaries fell dead and dying around her, their blood staining the expensive carpet. Her footing became uncertain as bodies cluttered the floor, and it was getting harder to find room to swing her sword.
We've got to get out of here while we still can!
Right!
Apoen slit a mercenary's throat.
Follow me!
They made a break for the door, plowing through the startled mercenaries and cutting down anyone who got in their way. They burst out into the hall, and Fisher was surprised to find it deserted. Apoen and Fisher headed for the stairs.
They don't know where the talks are really being held, so they're wasting time searching the house.
They took the steps two at a time.
But I know where there's an emergency entrance into the pocket I mentioned. We can hide out in there till the fighting's over.
What about your people? You can't just abandon them.
They know where the entrance is too. If they've got any sense, most of them are probably already there.
Fisher heard boots hammering up the stairs and threw herself forward. The mercenary sword swept past her head, the wind of its passing tugging at her hair. The heel of her boot thudded solidly into his groin. Fisher turned around to finish him off and found herself facing a dozen more mercenaries charging up the stairs toward her. She put a hand on the groaning swordsman's face and pushed him sharply backwards. He fell down the stairs and crashed into his fellows, bringing them all to an abrupt halt. Fisher smiled angelically at the chaos and turned her back on them. Apoen was nowhere to be seen.
Son of a bitch!
She hurried up the stairs to the landing, paused to get her bearings, then ran along the hallway, glaring about her. A mercenary burst out of a door just ahead of her, and Fisher ran him through while he was still gaping at her. She headed back quickly away as two more men charged out of the room at her. She put her back against the railing that ran the length of the hall and swung her sword in wide arcs to keep them at bay. 2-1 odds didn't normally bother her, but this time she was facing two hardened professionals in very cramped surroundings, with nowhere to retreat to and no one to guard her blindsides. It was at times like this she realized how much she missed Hawk. She cut viciously at one mercenary's face, and he stepped back instinctively. Fisher darted for the gap that opened up, but the other swordsman was already there, forcing her back with a flurry of blows. Fisher fought on, but she could feel her chances of getting out alive slipping away like sand between her fingers. And then one of the mercenaries went down in a flurry of blood, and Apowan was standing over him, flashing his lunatic grin. Fisher quickly finished off the other mercenary, and the two guards sprinted down the hallway with more mercenaries in hot pursuit.
Where the hell have you been? I turned my back on you for a minute, you were gone.
Sorry. I didn't notice you weren't still with me. Now save your breath for running. You got a way to go yet. Those bastards behind us are getting closer.
The two darted up a winding stairway. Fisher forced herself to run faster. She was already bone-tired after a long day, and her legs felt like lead, but somehow she forced out a little extra speed. Apowan, of course, was running well and strongly, buoyed up by his battle drug. Sweat ran down Fisher's face, stinging her eyes, and her sides ached as her lungs protested. She just hoped she wouldn't get a stitch. That would make it a perfect day.
Let's go! The doorway's here!
Fisher looked and saw an open door hanging unsupported in the air. Beyond the door, there was only darkness.
About time! I just hope the pocket dimension turns out to be a damn sight more secure than this house.
It is, I guarantee it. Now let's move it, please!
He grabbed her arm and hauled her through the doorway. Once shut, the doorway disappeared from the room. There was a brief sensation of falling, and then Fisher was in the Peace Talks' hidden room. The delegates rose, startled from their seats, around a long table, staring at her and Apowan. She quickly put up a hand to forestall their questions.
This house is overrun with mercenaries. We had to cut and run. No choice. How many more of our people made it here?
She took in their blank faces and looked away.
Oh, damn. And I think it's fair to assume they won't be coming. We're the only survivors.
She looked quickly around the sparsely furnished, medium-sized room, and then blinked as she found there was no sign of the doorway. All four walls were blank. She shrugged and looked at Apowan, who was sitting on the floor beside her with his head hanging down. He was deathly pale, with sweat streaming off his face and obviously using all his willpower to keep from vomiting. That was battle drugs for you. Great as long as adrenaline kept you going, but once you stopped, there was hell to pay. Fisher manhandled him into a chair and then turned back to the delegates. They were obviously waiting for a more detailed report, and it was clear from their faces that their patience had just about run out. Really, the report should come from Apowan, as the senior captain in charge of security, but since he was out of it and likely to stay that way for some time, Fisher realized she was still holding her sword and sheathed it. She drew herself up to parade rest, thought briefly about saluting the delegates, and then decided the hell with it.
We're in trouble. Someone hired a small army of mercenaries, backed them up with some heavy-duty sorcery, and sent them here looking for you. Our security forces didn't stand a chance. The mercenaries rolled right over us. Unless some more of our people arrive in the next few minutes, you'd better get used to the idea that your entire security force now consists of Apowan and me. And there aren't going to be any reinforcements. We're trapped in here, and the house is crawling with mercenaries.
Lord Regis adjusted his tunic.
It's not quite as bad as you make it sound, Captain. Firstly, we are quite safe here. The dimensional doorways won't open to the mercenaries, and the only other way is to open a new doorway. Even a high-level sorcerer couldn't do that without first knowing the exact coordinates of this dimension, and those are, of course, only known to a select few. All we have to do is sit tight and wait for the mercenaries to leave. They won't hang around once they realize we're not in the house. An attack like this is bound to have been noticed, especially in Lotori. I think we can be fairly confident that the guard is on its way here even as we speak.
Wait a minute. How will we know when it's safe to leave?
We'll just stick our heads out from time to time and see what's happening.
He means you and I will stick our heads out, Fisher. They're not going to take any risks. Right, my lord?
Of course. That is what you're here for, isn't it?
Fisher looked at Apowan. His face was still pale, but he was sitting up straight and he looked a lot more composed.
How are you feeling?
Great. The side effects don't last long.
Long enough to get you killed if they hit you at the wrong moment.
Apowan shrugged. Major de Tournay straightened up.
You're all missing the point.
How did the mercenaries know to look for us here? Our location was supposed to be secret.
He has a point.
Lord Regis looked heavily at Epoen. The senior captain nodded unhappily.
Somebody must have talked. Someone always talks eventually. But since they couldn't know about this dimension, it doesn't really matter. The mercenaries will just ransack the house, find no trace of the talks, and report back to their masters that you weren't here. They'll be called off, and you can resume the talks undisturbed, secure in the knowledge they won't be back again. If the guard reacts fast enough, they might even be able to follow the mercenaries back to their masters, and we can round them all up in one go.
Lord Nightingale brightened.
Excellent. This might turn out to have been all for the best after all.
Hold it just a minute. A lot of good men died out there trying to protect you and your precious talks. Doesn't that mean anything to you?
The two merchants, Rook and Gardner, had the grace to look a little embarrassed. The two majors stirred uncomfortably but said nothing. Lord Regis looked thoughtfully at the floor.
They were just doing their job. They understood they were expendable, as are we all.
I'm sure that'll be a great comfort to their spouses and children. Those men never stood a chance thanks to your insistence on low-profile security.
That's enough, Captain. It's not your place to criticize your superiors. We have to consider the bigger picture.
Fisher gave him a hard look and then turned away. Epoen relaxed slightly and felt his heart start beating again. He didn't think Fisher would actually punch out a lord, but you could never tell with Fisher.
His lordship is right, Fisher. The safety of the delegates must come first. That's what they told us when we took on this job, remember? Now take it easy. We're all perfectly safe in here. Nothing can reach us.
He broke off suddenly. They all stood silently, listening. The bell tolled again and again, growing slowly louder and more mournful, like the bell from a forgotten church deep in the gulfs of hell. Fisher's breathing quickened and her hand fell to her sword. Something was out there in the dark. She could feel it. Something awful. The pealing of the bell grew louder still, painfully loud, until everyone in the hidden room had their hands pressed to their ears. The air split open above them, and nightmares spewed out into the waking world. Creatures with insane shapes that hurt and disturbed the human eye fought and oozed and squirmed out of nowhere and fell writhing to the floor. There were things with splintered bones and snapping mouths, and nauseating shapes that twisted through strange dimensions as they moved. Creatures with flails and barbs and elongating limbs. A monstrous slug with grinding teeth in its belly fell heavily onto the conference table, its weight cracking the thick wood from end to end. A clump of ropey, crimson intestines squeezed out of the split in the air and dropped squirming to the floor where it dripped acid, eating holes in the carpet. For a moment, everyone froze where they were. Then Fisher threw herself forward.
Hell with this!
Strangely colored blood flew steaming on the air as her blade sank deep into unnatural flesh, and howling shapes rose up in fury all around her. Epoen was quickly at her side, and together they forced the demons back. Major Comer and Major de Tourney drew their swords and fought back to back, old enmities forgotten in the face of a common foe. They cut and thrust with professional efficiency, and nothing could stand against them for long. The two traitors, Rook and Gardner, retreated into a corner and defended themselves with unfamiliar swords as best they could. Creatures swarmed eagerly about them, scenting easy prey. Lord Regis fought stubbornly with his back to a wall, barely keeping the fangs and claws from his throat, but determined not to give in. Lord Nightingale cleared a space around him with inspired swordsmanship.
Nam Yote Name! Nam Yote Name!
Human blood flowed as the creatures pressed closer, forcing their way past flashing steel by sheer force of numbers. And still more shapes poured through the split in the air, and there seemed no end to them.
We've got to get out of here!
We can't! Only Regis and Nightingale could open the door. And they both look a bit busy at the moment. See if you can work towards them. Take some of the pressure off.
Fisher tried, but the growing tide of creatures forced her back foot by foot, and Epoen had to struggle to keep his place at her side. A jagged cut on his forehead leaked blood steadily down one side of his face, and he had to keep blinking his eye to clear it. A raking claw suddenly opened up a long, curving gash across Fisher's hip and stomach, and she stumbled and almost fell as the pain flared through her. Epoen darted in to try to cover her, and a long, serrated tentacle whipped around his shoulders and snatched him up into the air. Fisher hacked at the tentacle, but it wouldn't let him go. Comer and de Tourney were soaked with blood from a dozen minor wounds, but were holding their ground and grimly defying the creature to move them. Rook and Gardner had already fallen and disappeared beneath a heaving throng of frenzied shapes. Lord Regis struggled, tears of exhaustion running down his cheeks, but Lord Nightingale ignored him, concentrating on his rhythmic chanting.
Nam Yorten Ame! Nam Yorten Ame!
And then Nightingale gestured, and the split in the air slammed together and was gone. The creatures burst into flames, screaming and thrashing as a searing golden fire consumed them, leaving nothing but ash. The faraway bell was quiet, and the only sound in the hidden room was the harsh breathing and groans of the two guards and the surviving delegates. Fisher sat with her back braced against a wall, watching exhaustedly as Apoan slowly picked himself up from where the burning tentacle had dropped him. The two majors leaned on each other, exchanging quiet compliments. Lord Regis bent wearily over two bodies lying twisted and still in a corner, then straightened up and turned away. Rook and Gardner were beyond help. Regis looked across at Lord Nightingale, calmly cleaning the blood from his sword in the middle of the room.
I didn't know you're a sorcerer, Nightingale.
The Outremer Lord shrugged easily.
I'm not, really. I just like to dabble.
Still, I would have expected you to mention it, since one of the conditions for these talks was that none of the delegates be a sorcerer.
I told you, I'm not a sorcerer. Just a gifted amateur.
That's not the point.
Can we discuss this later? We need a doctor in here.
I'm afraid that's out of the question. We're under orders not to reveal our presence. Officially, no one is to know we're here.
You have got to be joking. If there's one thing we can be certain about, it's that our enemies know we're here. Both the mercenaries and those stinking creatures knew exactly how best to catch us off guard. Somebody's talked. We're not a secret anymore. So forget the low-profile nonsense and get some real protection in here. We were lucky this time. We won't be again. Get me a doctor, damn it! If this wound gets infected, I'll sue!
Sometime later, after a number of hasty but effective healing spells, Fisher and Epoan made their rounds of the house, looking over their new, improved security force and checking the faces of the dead mercenaries before they were carried out. None of the mercenaries had been taken alive. Those who hadn't managed to escape before guard reinforcements arrived killed themselves rather than be captured.
Which suggests to me that they were under a Aegis. It had to be some kind of magical compulsion. Mercenaries don't believe in that kind of loyalty to a cause. Any cause. We fight strictly for cash, nothing else. I wondered if I might know any of these poor bastards. But I don't recognize any faces. Probably hired outside Haven to prevent any rumors of the attack from getting out. You couldn't hope to have this many men in Haven and keep it quiet.
Right. Somebody always talks. Which brings us back to the attack on the pocket dimension. Someone betrayed us. But who knew?
Not many. The delegates, you and I, and the 10 guards working inside the house, and Commander Glenn, of course.
He stopped suddenly. Epoan and Fisher looked at each other.
Glenn?
Why not? He's the only one who had nothing to risk by talking.
Epoan shook his head firmly.
Glenn's a hard bastard, but he's no traitor. Much more likely one of my people talked to the wrong person before they came here, and that person sold us out.
Fisher nodded unhappily. She couldn't ask any of Epoan's people about it. None of them survived the mercenaries' attack.
That's not our only problem. Nightingale's knowledge of magic has got everyone worked up. Admittedly, he saved all our asses when the creatures broke through. But now Regis and Major Comer are worried sick he could be using his magic to influence their minds during the talks. Still, they accepted him as a delegate, and if they reject him now, Outremer will undoubtedly retaliate in kind. What progress they have achieved so far will all have been for nothing. So for the moment, the talks are officially in abeyance until Rook and Gardner can be replaced. And you can bet Haven's replacement will know some sorcery just to be on the safe side.
Damn politics. At least the talks will continue. That's something.
Until the next attack.
You think there'll be another one?
Bound to be. Too many interests want these talks to fail. And we're still stuck right in the middle. And I thought being a guard would be a nice cushy number after being a mercenary.
This is where the Guard Advisory Council meets? Ah. Seen more impressive outhouses. Maybe you were right after all, Burns. Anyone who has to meet in a dump like this isn't going to be in any position to help us.
Burns kept a diplomatic silence, but his shrug spoke volumes. Hawk glared at the building before him and wondered if there was any point in going inside. The Guard Advisory Council held its meetings in a rented room over a corner grocer's shop. The kind that stays open all hours, selling anything and everything. The two-story building seemed fairly well preserved, but looked like it hadn't seen a coat of paint in generations. Hawk peered into the shop through the single smeared window. One glance at the interior was enough to convince him he'd have to be awfully hungry before he ate anything that came from this grocer. He could practically see plague and food poisoning hiding in the shadows and giggling together. And he didn't want to think about what the unfamiliar cut of meat optimistically labeled special offer might be. Hawk turned away and looked around the street. Passers-by kept their heads down to avoid his gaze and hurried by the two guards, trying hard to look innocent and failing miserably. Mostly, they just succeeded in looking furtive. It was that kind of neighborhood.
I did try to tell you, Hawk. These people are advisors, and that's all. They have no real power or influence, even if they like to think they have. They come up with the odd good idea on occasion, and they're good public relations, so the guard tolerates them. But that's as far as it goes.
Maybe, but none of that's important. What matters is that these people are connected to the guard, but not a part of it. They ought to know some of what's going on, but still be distant enough that they can talk to us without fear of retribution. Damn it, Burns, I need someone to talk to me. I need information. We're flailing around in the dark and getting nowhere, and Morgan's sitting out there somewhere safe and secure, laughing at us. We need a lead. Something to point us in the right direction, at least.
And you think we're going to get that from the Guard Advisory Council?
It's worth a try, dammit. We've got to do something.
He strode angrily forward, ignored the shop doorway, and stomped up the iron fire escape that clung uncertainly to the side of the building. Burns followed him silently. His partner was getting desperate, and it was beginning to show. Hawk stopped before the plain wooden door at the top of the fire escape. Someone behind a sliding panel studied Hawk for a long moment. The now unbolted door swung open, and Hawk and Burns stepped inside.